Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hello and welcome to a weekend podcast of The Lotus Eaters. I'm here with Josh, and today we're going to be continuing our discussion from yesterday about biases and about how to avoid biases and this kind of thing. And so before we start, I just wanted to reiterate what I already said yesterday, that we will be renaming this weekend podcast. It's going to be called something else. We're not sure about what the name is going to be yet.
We're open to suggestions.
What we are sure about is that it's not going to be going up on this channel on YouTube. It's on YouTube. It's going to be on our other channel, which is just The Lotus Eaters. This is the podcast of The Lotus Eaters. We have the other channel as well. You can find that in the description or on the screen somewhere. I don't know where John's going to put it, but it's going to be there. And so if you want to follow the weekend podcast or what is going to become of them in the future, we'll see you there. But today we're going to be talking about biases, and we're going to go into prospect theory, framing effect, and mere exposure effect. And I have no idea what these are, so I'll let Josh explain this.
I would also like to add that you can also find us on the website, and we're not going to go anywhere on there. We're going to be in the same place, and that's probably the best place to find us.
Yeah, thank you. That's lotuseaters.com, obviously. So
I would like to talk about prospect theory to start, which is a theory of behavioral economics, which has kind of describes lots of biases within it. And so if you can see the graph on screen, it shows that losses and gains are valued differently. So faced with risky choices leading to gains, individuals are risk averse, preferring solutions that lead to lower expected utility but with higher certainty. So expected utility is just expected gains. And faced with risky choices leading to losses, individuals are risk-seeking, preferring solutions that lead to lower expected utility as long as it has the potential to avoid the losses. So if people are faced with the chance of making losses, they're more willing to take risks than they are with the prospect of making gains. And research has suggested that this is about 2-to-1 siding with the losses. So
the average person is willing to forego twice the gain for a certain amount of losses. Potential gain, potential losses.
So in the graph here, you can see -$0.05 mm-hmm. has like a loss value of 40, whereas a gain of $0.05 is just below 20.
Right.
So the loss is viewed as twice as valuable mm-hmm. as the gain.
And so that's what they found for an average person in that study.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How does that kind of manifest in real life? Where does it come into play with people's regular lives?
So it affects how people pursue their goals in many cases, because people are what could be described as loss averse, which is a form of bias where people tend to prefer avoiding losses to acquiring the equivalent gains. So losses are twice as psychologically impactful as the equivalent gains. So you can look at this in the context of something known as the endowment effect, which people place a higher value on a good that they own than an identical good that they do not own. So things that people have are more valuable to them than things they don't, if they are equivalent or the same, if that makes any sense.
And so how does that tie into, for example, the idea of excuse me, of like the grass being greener on the other side, right? So you envy someone something that they have that if you have it, it's not as great, right? Like that happens quite often, and like so that goes kind of the opposite direction, right? So how does that work?
I mean, that's a good question. I'm not sure how it differs between differing domains. I would imagine that there'd be certain situations where this would apply and other situations where the kind of loss aversion and the endowment effect apply more so. So
might it be something like when I have a mug and you have the same mug, mm-hmm. I value my mug more because I've got an emotional attachment to it, or is it something else?
I think it could be something along those lines. I think you've got the gist of what I'm trying to get at here, that people are more focused on not losing what they have than they are potentially gaining additional things. And there's a good reason for this, or so it's hypothesized, and it's believed that we're hardwired to be loss averse due to something known as asymmetric evolutionary pressure on losses and gains. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading a quote here. For an organism to operate close to the edge of survival, the loss of a day's food could cause death, whereas the gain of an extra day's food would not cause an extra day of life unless the food could easily and effectively be stored.
Right. So that makes sense. Yeah.
That's why this kind of thing has emerged, and it's not just exclusive to human beings. There's lots of non-human primates that also have loss aversion, as we talked about in one of the previous weekend podcasts. We talked about capuchins that also showed some loss aversion as well. So,
and how it ties to Marx's views.
That's the one, yeah.
Yep. Okay, so excuse me. So if we have this kind of loss aversion effect, mm-hmm. That is, if I understand it correctly, basically a reformulation of marginal utility in economics or something like that. So if you have like one unit of something, you're going to value that more if it's a good to you than another unit of the same good, mm-hmm. right? So just because if you have some goals to which you put these goods, some use for it, the most urgent use, the most valued use is going to be the first unit is going to be sure. used for the primary goal. So the goal that is second in rank is going to be fulfilled by the second unit, and so mm-hmm. that's the second unit is less valuable because it can mm-hmm. fulfill the second goal, which is the less valuable one.
Having more things kind of has a diminishing return to it is the gist of what you're trying to say there, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's a psychological reiteration of that kind of law.
This is the psychology of behavioral decision making, which is a part of behavioral economics. So it's where economics and psychology overlap. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a bit of each in these theories, or at least in prospect theory, mm-hmm. because it is largely a theory of economizing man. It's trying to understand the psychological components, but the actual topic under investigation is the economic component, if that makes any sense.
Right, right. So it's reaching the same conclusion, but from the opposite end. Not from theorizing about what people do and figuring out what consequences that leads to or mm-hmm. implications leads to, but seeing, okay, people are loss averse, people do this with their life situations, and therefore, we can explain mm-hmm. it in this way. Right?
Yeah, the theory was developed from observations in experiments, and then they collected the data and worked kind of backwards to develop the theory, as opposed to the economics, which was theory, and then they looked at the data to back up their theory. So it's kind of a mirror image,
right?
And there is, however, some research that suggests that the psychological impact may not necessarily influence people's future decisions, although it has twice the impact to make the equivalent gains, it may not actually influence your behavior in the future. And there's been some kind of differing conclusions about...
What does that mean? Why? So if it's not behavior that's affected by this, so what then is?
They're making the distinction that just because someone has a psychological reaction to something mm-hmm. doesn't necessitate that they're going to act upon that like reaction. So they could say, well, you feel negatively about something, but then you may still not do anything to alter your behavior.
Well, I thought it was this was kind of measured, or this was observed through people's behavior, because I would imagine mm-hmm. that they would
in some studies it has been, yeah. And it's just a source of contention between some research, and I want to be clear that it's not a given that this is something that can be found, that the evidence seems to suggest that it is, and there's something going on there, but it may not necessarily have as much significance as you may initially think, just at a surface level.
Right.
So I just want to emphasize that people look at it in a proportionate way to how the evidence seems to suggest people both feel and behave about these sorts of things.
Right, okay. Yeah, makes sense.
That clears it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And under the kind of umbrella of prospect theory, there are also some other effects that I would like to quickly kind of go over but not go into great detail about, is there's something known as the ambiguity effect, which is the tendency to avoid options which the probability of a favorable outcome is unknown, and that is just decision under uncertainty. People prefer certain outcomes about making gains, and they don't like risks about that sort of thing. But when there is a risk about a loss, there's obviously potential to mitigate the loss as much as possible with the risk. And there's also something known as dread aversion, which is taking it into the emotional sphere again, that losses yield double the emotional impact of gains, and dread yields double the emotional impact of savoring.
What does that mean?
So, like, negative feelings of anticipation in the future are twice as significant as savoring something that is good.
Right, right. So it's not just appreciation of what happens, but the expectations as well.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Expectation plays a large part in human behavior. Many behaviors are where you think they're reinforced by an act itself. It's actually the anticipation of the act that is the thing that is positively reinforced. So eating food, you'd think the neurochemical involved in kind of good feelings or dopamine, you think, well, the first bite would be where it peaks, but actually just before, the anticipation of having the first bite of this food is where it peaks, and then it kind of drops down just before you actually...
Right, right, right.
Which is really counterintuitive. You'd think that it would correspond to, as soon as you have that first bite of food, you taste the food, this isn't a great experience. It seems so weird to talk about it like that, but...
No, that's okay. I know what you're saying. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, so expectation plays far more of an important role than we might otherwise think, but this is, again, a tangent, so I'm sorry. And there's also the final bias I'm going to mention, although there are some others as well, is the status quo bias, which is the tendency to like things to stay relatively the same. And viewed in the kind of prism of prospect theory, you can understand why that would be, because if things stay static, you're not going to make any losses, which are viewed more significant than the gains. So if things stay the same, then there's no risk.
Yeah. So there's need to be significant gains expected before you actually start to want to play.
Exactly.
Yep.
There's got to be enough of a motivation to take a risk in the first place for someone to want to change their situation. Mm-hmm. There's like a minimum threshold that has to be crossed.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so let's move on to the framing effect.
Sure. So the framing effect is a form of cognitive bias in which people make decisions based upon whether options presented are framed positively or negatively, despite being objectively the same. And I'm actually working on a premium article for our website about this, which looks into it in greater detail, so I don't want to spoil too much about that. But what I am going to do is talk about one of the key experiments,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Which I feel is all the more relevant in the modern day and age. So the original experiment was conducted by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, who I've mentioned before. They are the people who came up with dual process theory, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorite theories.
If you don't know what we're talking about, take a look at yesterday's podcast.
Absolutely. And they were the first to explore the influence people's decisions have from phrasing. And this was in 1981. And they posed the participants with this scenario. Imagine that the US is preparing for an outbreak of an unusual Asian disease. Shouldn't be too hard to imagine. Which is expected to kill 600 people. Two alternative programs to combat the disease have been proposed. Assume that the exact scientific estimate of the consequences are as follows. And they have two conditions where they have it framed positively and they have it framed negatively. So within these positive and negative frames, they have two programs. In the positive frame, it's A and B, and in the negative frame, it's C and D. So in the positive frame, they say if program A is adopted, 200 people will be saved. And in program B, if this is adopted, there is a 1/3 probability that 600 people will be saved and a 2/3 probability that no one will be saved. And in the negative frame, if program C is adopted, 400 people will die. If program D is adopted, there is a 1/3 probability that nobody will die and a 2/3 probability that 600 people will die.
So have they made sure before that people understand probabilities and how they work?
Well, good question. Most people don't really understand probability, I don't think. And it's even more so the case when it's in abstraction. In this case, it's pretty grounded in, you know, they've given
specific
numbers, and you can...
The numbers are
whole,
you know, there's no...
And the more perceptive of you might have noticed that all four of these options have the same expected values, that 200 lives were saved and 400 are lost. And this is the same for all four of the options.
Yeah. And that's the point.
That is the point, yeah. So both program A and program C are also equivalent in terms of the probabilities and the way they're presented. And the same is true of program B and D, as you surely have figured out. But however, despite the equivalence of outcomes in the positive frame condition, 72% of participants preferred program A, where they said 200 people will be saved, and 78% of people preferred program D, where they said there was a 1/3 probability that nobody will die and 2/3 probability that 600 people will die. And although these are exactly the same, these are pretty resounding preferences, aren't they?
Yep. So is that... I'm thinking of some of the reactions that, or framings that politicians and a lot of public personalities have been using throughout this pandemic, like saying, okay, this number of people will be saved if we do this. You know, we can avoid X amount of deaths, right? And so it's usually framed in this way and not in the other way. Not saying, okay, this amount of people will die, but if we don't do it, some more people will die, right?
Yeah, they don't tend to contextualize the numbers, because if you compare the number saved and the number of people dying without a frame of reference, it's easier to have like an effect on this bias, if you know it, or influence people with this bias is a better way of putting it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what the problem is when someone is talking about a death toll from COVID, for example, right? In some country that most people don't know much about,
yeah.
And they're saying, look, 2,000 people have died. Mm-hmm. Okay, so does that country have a million population or a billion population?
it's something that I've been saying for a long time, that people need a frame of reference to be able to actually understand large numbers. If you just say, you know, 100,000 people have died in the UK from COVID, it sounds really awful, which it obviously is. But if you contextualize it by saying, you know, 500,000 people die of flu, I've just made that up, by the way. I don't know whether that's the actual statistic, but it would seem not nearly as bad as it had been otherwise. Whereas if you say, well, only 50,000 people die of flu, well, that's double. So that sounds way worse. And it's about not anchoring it to something that people already have experience with, which makes you more susceptible, I feel.
Also with large numbers, I've noticed that with large numbers, the problem becomes at some point that you can't really visualize those numbers, right? So if we're talking about like money, right? And and you're talking in like thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions, right? People can imagine that, you know, they can they can relate that with the amount they earn, for example, or things like that. But if you get into like staggering amounts of money where like national debt, for example, right?
Of course,
or something like that. It gets into the territory where people can't even comprehend those numbers, and like you can't blame them because it's something that they can't relate to their daily lives and to the amounts that they count the money in, right? So if you say okay, the national debt has risen from whatever 5 trillion to 15 trillion, like okay, like what is that? You know, I have no idea what that means. Yeah. You know, because it's something that's so far removed from the amounts that I work with all my life that it literally makes no difference to me, even though it's a huge difference, right?
I'd be more than happy to get used to working with trillions, but alas,
can move to Zimbabwe. That's a reference to our last weekend podcast.
So, unusually, most biases tend to decrease as we get older, but this one actually increases as you age, which seems to be encompassed in the view that we are more sensitive to negativity when we're older. So we would become even more loss averse as we age because we have like a greater negativity bias.
Right. And is that explained within the evolutionary framework similarly, so that if you get older you're probably more fragile, your body is more kind of can be hurt more easily, and so you try to avoid like every single loss. So if you're whatever 80 and you kind of slip and fall, that might seriously hurt you, whereas if you're 20 probably nothing's going to happen to you, right?
Yeah, that seems perfectly intuitive, but I can't say for certain, but well, any evolutionary stuff, you can't say for certain because you've got no data, but it's all speculation. But you can kind of figure things out through kind of logical reasoning and perhaps gene testing. And I won't get into that, though, because I will talk for hours about that. So this kind of thing can also be mitigated against through credible sources giving advice, which has been demonstrated by Druckmann, who in his study Using Credible Advice to Overcome Framing Effects, he describes how credible advice dramatically decreases and sometimes eliminates framing effects.
So what does that mean? Is that if they're presented with those four options that we talked about before, or like two of them, if someone else says, look, you should probably choose this, they will?
Yeah, so in the experiment they used... They found out the political leanings of the participants, and they said, your political party would suggest this option. Mm-hmm. And they actually used the same experiment as Kahneman and Tversky. Nice. So they used the same experiment, and they said, okay, the recommended program from your political party of choice is this, and that seems to mitigate against it. So... Druckmann says, it is plausible that outside of a laboratory, people do in fact access and use advice from others, especially in situations where they feel ill-informed about their preferences.
Yep.
So this is suggesting that if you don't really feel confident about something, going out and seeking advice is actually a good idea. Who would have guessed? I know.
And it's actually what people do if they don't feel certain about their own views.
So what he's trying to propose here is that although these biases exist in the laboratory, you're not going to necessarily find them to the same extent, perhaps, in some people outside. Although there's still going to be some relics of it because it's something that is kind of hardwired into you, I feel.
Right. Makes sense.
And I'd just like to touch on some kind of sub-effects within the framing effect. The first one is the decoy effect, where preferences for either option A or B change in favour of option B when option C is presented, which is completely dominated by option B and inferior in all respects and partially dominated by option A. So that sounds very wordy and complicated, but when framed between, when given the choice between two options, and you introduce an inferior option, which is worse than both, mm-hmm. it seems to influence your decision between the previous two.
Okay.
Even though...
It shouldn't.
Yeah, it shouldn't. Objectively speaking, this option is irrelevant,
yep.
but people
doesn't
feel
it,
like...
It doesn't affect the trade-offs between the two, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
And that's the gist of that, that people don't always consider additional options in a kind of objective manner.
And so in which way does it move the needle? Towards the best option or the second best?
Towards the what they perceive as the best option, as in that they're saying that option B seems to be the better one here in their perception. So it moves it even further away, where mm-hmm. the decision would have been relatively close beforehand. The introduction of this inferior option, which is not worthy of consideration, moves it even further towards their preference.
Right. So they kind of create in their heads the like two groups, mm-hmm. like the best option and then the rest, right? Mm-hmm. So they group together the ones that are not the best one.
Yeah.
So they they move them closer together and bundle them in their mind, even though they have nothing to do with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's more or less it. And there's also something known as the default effect, which is when a given choice between several options, the tendency is to favour the default one.
That's what you were talking about earlier, right?
Yeah. So this is just another take on that, mm-hmm. where people tend to deviate towards the norm, and that's not only just a statistical truth, it's also something that people are socially pressured to do, as we discussed in part one. And the final kind of sub-effect is the distinction bias, where the tendency to view two options is more dissimilar when evaluating them simultaneously than when you evaluate them separately. So you have two options between things, and if you evaluate them at the same time, you'll might come to a different conclusion than if you evaluated each one
right.
separately yeah. or in two different instances.
So there can be something as basic as telling apart colors. Right. So if you see like two colors, one after mm-hmm. another, you will tend to say they are more similar than if you'd see them side by side and see the difference between them.
Like, yeah, that's a good example, actually. I'm pretty sure that's actually an experiment. I can't remember the exact details of it, but they even measured the interval in seconds, mm-hmm. how long it took before the effect disappeared, and supposedly it was about 30 seconds.
Right.
I think they had different colours of paint.
Oh, but, okay.
But this is going back years and years, and I can't remember all the details, so I don't want to get into it too much.
I was thinking about these kind of mind tricks, right? These like pictures mm-hmm. where you have a background, right? And then in the foreground you have some kind of object, and one side of the object is angled in one way and the other. So your mind kind of fills in a source of light, which is supposed to cast
like
a shadow, right?
An optical illusion sort of thing.
And so in that picture you have two things that have the same color, that are the same color, but it seems to you like they're a completely different color. But if you like block out one part of the picture with your hand, you can actually see that they are the same color, and it's kind of, what's going on?
I think that is in part because of something known as binocular rivalry, mm. which is just how seeing with two different eyes, that sounds really weird, but because your vision, you have like a cohesive picture, but you have two sources, there's some degree of overlap where there's competing in the brain, which is why you have these optical illusions where they flip between different things. So the one that is cited in psychology a lot is there's a picture of a rabbit and a duck that yep, are kind of yep, fused together, yep. and the longer you look at it, the more it flips. However, interestingly enough, again, another tangent, but Buddhist monks tend to have far less perceptual switching, and they've been found to have far greater attention for whatever reason.
So whatever they see, if they see a duck or they see a rabbit, they stick to it?
Yeah, they just see one thing
right
for a long time. And I think the experiment showed that even when they're looking at it for 60 seconds, a normal person might see it and it might flip every second or so. They can see it for a full minute and it stays exactly the same, which is quite an extreme difference, really.
Yeah. So has the Laurel Yenny kind of experiment been conducted on monks?
Not to my knowledge. Although I have looked at that very briefly.
Be interesting, you know. Anyway, continuation of your career.
I'd rather not look at stuff like that, thanks. So anyway, onto the mere exposure effect, which is the tendency to express undue liking for things merely because you're familiar with them. So the best person to kind of look at for research in this is Robert Zajonc, who kind of looked at it from the 60s onwards, and he's the one who's most associated with this mere exposure effect, and he is cited as the 35th most cited psychologist in the 20th century. So
nice.
He's got pretty well renowned through researching this. And there was a meta-analysis in 1987, which kind of meta-analysis, for anyone who doesn't know, is just a study of all of the existing studies. So it's a way of drawing conclusions from a huge wealth of research. And it actually looked at 208 experiments looking at the mere exposure effect, which is a huge number considering many meta-analysis studies maybe look at 50 to 100. So this is a very large sample of the psychological literature. And they found that this effect was both robust and reliable and very easy to demonstrate. So this seems to be one of the stronger biases that we've talked about in this two-part series. And they found that the effect was strongest when you were presented with something that was unfamiliar and it was presented briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And
so do they measure it as, like, they present you with two options and one of them you know very well and has a set expected payoff, and then you have another option that has a much higher payoff but you don't know it, something like that?
It's far more general than that. It's just things that you are familiar with you prefer more than things that you aren't, even if you have no reason to prefer them. So
yeah, but that's kind of what I meant, right?
Okay,
so how do you measure if you have nothing to gain, right? Or if there's nothing, no good reason, right? How do you measure there not being a good reason? You measure that by artificially, like, making the new option much better than the old one.
Sure.
Or that's at least what I'm
yeah, thinking. The experiments researching it largely looked at people's reported preferences for certain things and how they were altered. So they can either explicitly ask them, or they can more kind of covertly ask them about their mood before and after the experiment.
Right.
And that can be framed somewhat deceptively to say, okay, this experiment is dependent on you being in a certain frame of mind. So they might not actually be aware that this is key to the experiment. So they're not likely to, or at least they're less likely to report things that may be untruthful, which is a big problem with asking people about things, that there's something known as a social desirability effect, where if you ask participants in an experiment, they'll just tell you what they think you want to hear rather than what is actually the case. And that's true of things outside of experiments as well.
And so has the have some of these studies been also done in this kind of numerical, through this numerical method, rather than just self-reporting about how people feel?
So
because that would seem to me like more robust.
There's been countless like methods employed in this very, I mean, with 208 experiments, you could imagine that everything under the sun has probably been tried and tested already. So, and of course, if they're testing for it to be both robust and reliable. These are going to be statistical, mathematical tests of probability that this is all by chance. And with 200 experiments,
I'm not doubting the usage of statistics. I'm saying if you feed the statistical model data that is self-reported and that's saying, okay, I feel better, I feel worse, then I mean, trash in, trash out. So
sure. And most psychologists are really skeptical of what people tell them anyway. It's just in general, really. No one's laboring under the illusion that what people are telling them is truthful, and there's always reason to doubt. But the assumption tends to be that the majority of people will be truthful, and therefore the trend is what you want to look at rather than individual cases per se. So the example I'd like to kind of pull out from the mere exposure effect is that people generally like a song more after they've heard it a few times, but many repetitions can reduce this preference. And as someone who's a musician, this is something very close to my heart, that a lot of music is kind of capitalizing on the mere exposure effect of people liking things that they're familiar with. And especially popular music, which I would argue is engineered to make money rather than anything of artistic merit or value.
So the repetition of a chorus, for example.
Yeah, so they want to make it similar enough so it's familiar, but different enough so there's still the novelty aspect to it. And that's actually been explicitly said by the people who write songs for most of the main people in music, and I think it equates to the same two people have wrote the number one hits for 90% of all music in the UK and US, and they've explicitly said, like, listen, this is what we do. We're pretty open about it.
So you said that some number of repetition is where the maximal potential is reached of this effect, right?
Yeah.
And then it goes back down. Mm-hmm. Did you know that there is this one person on Reddit that keeps listening to the song In The End by Linkin Park?
I've actually come across that.
Over like several years, he's listened to it like 64,000 times or something like that.
And isn't it the only song that they had as well?
Yeah. And like when people asked him about it, like why do you not listen to other songs? And he's like, I don't like other songs.
I mean, I don't think any amount of study of this individual could ever allow me to understand this.
He's still listening, so the numbers are still going up. He posts updates every now and then.
I don't know why anyone would do that to themselves. I don't even like the song. Like, it's a cheesy song.
It's not bad if you listen to it less than 64,000 times.
Once is too much. So, supposedly a delay between the exposure and measurement of liking something actually tends to increase the strength of the effect. So if someone's exposed to something, they progressively like it more, which seems, even when it's removed and they're not being asked about it, it's not being brought to mind, it's almost like it has a gradual effect that builds up over
time. It's a kind of nostalgia.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, really. It does seem a bit like a form of nostalgia.
So you're selectively forgetting the bad experiences you've had and you're keeping the good ones.
Exactly, yeah. And also, weirdly enough, the effect is weaker in children. And it's also weaker for drawings and paintings compared to other types of stimuli, which we don't actually have any conclusive answers to why that is, at least none that I'm aware of, which seems very strange to me. You'd think that the subjectivity of things like drawings and paintings would be kind of rife for the familiarity effect, right?
So if you hear a song and you don't listen to it for some time, you report that you like it more. If you look at a painting and you're asked about it in the future, you say that it was trash.
In very base terms, I guess so. But I think it's more that the effect is weaker for the paintings. Like there's more consistency. There's still a little bit, but it's less extreme than in other domains, which is very unusual.
So it doesn't actually go down, it goes less up.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know whether you have any idea why that might be.
What I said is kind of kind of place into it, I think, the nostalgia thing. Mm-hmm. Is that with all your experiences, you tend to remember the good ones and forget the bad ones, like except for the ones that were kind of traumatic in some ways, right?
Sure.
So if it's mundane bad experiences, you forget about them, but you tend to remember the good ones. But, and that's, I don't know why that is. Well, like obviously, but what I'm thinking is that okay, if you want to maintain some kind of positive approach to life, it kind of helps mm-hmm. you. Because you look back at your life, you know, and you say, okay, it was not as crap as I thought. And yeah, you know, and even if you feel bad at the moment, you say, okay, like it's actually not that bad if I look back at what I've gone through, right?
So and it's a product of looking back in time rather than of the actual content of the memories themselves.
What would seem to me be mm-hmm. the case, but I don't know anything about it. It's just that kind of feels right.
Well, that ties in well to the fact that you can recall memory imperfectly, as in you store memories far more accurately, but things are lost in recall, and things can be added in recall that otherwise weren't there or have been changed.
The advice is if you have a good memory from a long time ago, don't remember it because you're going to add to it or subtract it.
Yeah. And this is something that is used in things like eyewitness testimony, where people who have kind of been asked leading questions might misremember things, and they're being honest and kind of forthright with the person they're talking to about their account. But in saying, okay, was there a person with a gun? They might think, oh, there could have been a gun actually. Well, maybe there was. And then in their memories, they create it. Yeah.
So that's a bit similar to the framing effect, right? Saying, okay, like it's framed like that. It's saying, this situation. Do you remember this very dangerous situation that happened? You know, and they're like, okay, it must have been dangerous. If they're saying it was dangerous, and you kind of make it more dangerous in your head.
And it is exactly the framing that is the thing that's influencing it. So it ties in very well, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's good. So. Is that everything on the mere exposure effect?
It is indeed, and that will bring us to the end of this second part.
And so what would you say that is the main kind of takeaway from these? Is it similar to what we were saying before, that if you the more you're aware of these effects and of these biases that people can have, the more you're able to kind of prevent them?
Yes,
prevent them having power over you in your own life and decision making.
So. The easiest thing to do is just take more time to make your decisions. That much is very clear. You're more likely to avoid the pitfalls if you take time to think things through. And being aware of these specific biases also helps you out, because if you're aware of them, you can identify where they're going to be relevant and how you can kind of identify the patterns of thought and behavior that are manifesting in yourself. So you could say, okay, I'm reading some news. I'm going to watch out for the framing, because they might be trying to make me believe something that I might not otherwise think. And therefore, you can reading through it with a critical mind is going to help you be more resistant against kind of propagandizing and things of that sort.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Well, if you like this podcast, well, then... switch to the other channel and subscribe to the other channel that's just called The Lotus Eaters, because we're going to be moving this weekend program to that channel and not keeping it here. So we'll see you there next week. And if you'd like to see more content, premium and non-premium, written and video, it's all on lotuseaters.com, where you can find us anytime.
Thanks for watching.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.